one of the way the Dharma helps us is it helps us free us from our drama. You know, and our drama is all about kind of our personal self-neuroses, gyrations. But the Dharma helps us free from that. And just because of that, it helps us cherish ourselves, to have like a real kind of clear, lovely honoring of who we are, our true nature, our empty true nature, if you will, or our Buddha nature, which there's a paradox right there. But, you know, the more we realize there's ultimately no self, then we realize there's no self to feel bad about, and not like because of whatever characteristics we might be adhered to. And this whole awakening to not-self, we were just talking to Eric about, you know, it's kind of confounding, and it's sort of, runs against our self-preservation, runs against our instincts to see through our congealed sense of self. But there's also this huge upside, that the more we can let go of our stuckedness to it, the more we can feel freedom from any kind of self-judgment that any of us may have about whatever characteristics we might tend to judge ourselves. And this is some echoes I was pointing at Brittany, because some aspects of what I'm talking about, I subbed for somebody.
Really?
Thank you. I subbed for Carrie at Sims. So there's some aspects of what I'm talking about now, I talked about then a little bit. So I'm just joking. Brittany's heard a little bit of this, but it's pretty different. So I hope you're patient. So, and one of the things I talked about is, you know, in my own spiritual journey, this whole thing of awakening, I just in junior high school, in retrospect, I keep thinking, oh my goodness, I was really like working it, because I think they call it middle school here in Washington. This is junior high school on the East Coast. But I first started, and probably you've had a similar experience, like when you're kind of tipping into adulthood, like in your teens, and you first start understanding, getting a sense of the psychological complexities of adult humans. It's like, oh my goodness, they are like, you know, and all these adult humans around me, I realized they were kind of a mess, a lot of them. You know, they were kind of a neurotic mess, and also myself, you know, coming of age, and it's a struggle in this weird sort of cultural thing of that school system, you know, the tribal thing of high school or junior high in terms of all your peers and trying to position yourself and wondering who's cool and who's not and all that. And then just starting to become aware of my own conditioned aspects from wherever they came, and not being able to talk to anybody to the depth that I was beginning to see, because, you know, who could meet you? So it was hard. It was hard. But I also started to see, and this is where this is relevant, is it was a question of what is the intrinsic part of a person that they could be judged for, or they could be categorized for. Because even back then, it was a lot of lip service about beauty only goes skin deep, you know, so everyone liked all the pretty people, whether male or female, but at least people knew that it sort of only went skin deep. But then I started questioning the origins or the intrinsic importance of other attributes, like, oh, is someone smarter or not? You know, or is someone skilled at playing athletics or a violin or whatever they're skilled at, you know, okay. People would laud those people as if they were intrinsically significant, that they could do those things, where they wouldn't laud someone for being beautiful. That was too embarrassing, and they knew that was wrong. But the other part, that happened all the time. And I started wondering, well, what about that? Even that, it's not intrinsically anything. It's like, some people are smart, you know. What did that mean? And to what degree was that a definition that actually wasn't true? And was there a freedom to be found by seeing through that? And, you know, the smartness thing, I'm not the smartest person around, and I grew up in Fairfield County, Connecticut, which some of you know is kind of like the Medina of the East Coast. So there were lots of very smart people in my junior high school, whatever. because I had very smart, successful parents and they had good genes, whatever. So it was daunting, you know, way smarter than me. Just incredibly, and became incredible lawyers and stuff like that, a bunch of them. But I had to work with that. And really that stayed with me through the entire path is how do we understand the qualities that we and other people have and be able to, you know, recognize them, but not think that they're intrinsically who we or other people are, and then judge each other because of those, or ourselves because of those. Because in truth, every facet of who we are, in our intelligence, our obsessions, our fears, our quirks, our skills, you know, if we have someone can play an instrument who's a prodigy, or someone has an incredible intuition for math, it comes from somewhere. It comes from conditioning, it comes from training and genetics and karma and who knows what. But it comes from somewhere. It's not just sort of like quality of them intrinsically. There's causes and conditions. So in a sense, each of those aspects that anyone has is a resultant visitor. It's not an inherent, ultimately inherent quality when you talk about the ultimate nature of things. It's part of the stream of causality and impermanence. And the Buddha understood this. You know, it's when you look at his teachings from this point of view, look at his teachings and how he relates to people, and he's always coming up against someone who presents him with something in the suttas, and it's sort of like it's a stuck quality, or it's something they have an opinion about, or it's some way they're positioning themselves, and he just sees through it, and he's always trying to bring people forward to their potential for awakening and not leave them stuck in whatever little logjam of categorization they may be in. And sometimes it means they think they're a Brahmin. I'm a Brahmin, I'm the best, I'm the top of the pile, caste-wise. The Buddha said, no, sorry. You're only a Brahmin because of what you do. You know, he doesn't accept on any aspect of it. He's always bringing people out of their intrinsic identifications and helping them see that it comes from somewhere, that it's a stream of causation. And for us, you know, for any one of the places where they're hard for us about our melange of qualities, you know, the sticky places, they stick up like little cankers. I think that's the right word, like little sores. And they bug us. You know, and they're irritating and they're inflamed and they're hot buttons if someone pushes them, and they're kind of more a bit embarrassed by them and we wish they weren't there. All these different aspects of our psyches. But the good news is they're not intrinsically us. They're sort of removable in the sense that insofar as we stop sticking to them, they'll change. And it's ultimately nothing to feel bad about or regret because it's not intrinsically us. Now, as we know, the Buddha was systematic, and he broke down the questions of our sense of self into the five skandhas, or khandhas in Pali. And this is my apologies to Brittany, because I did talk about this, but in a different way on Monday. Because the five skandhas are amazing, because they help us kind of like walk through different aspects of our selfing. And it was kind of a different question about wisdom on Monday. So I kind of thought about it differently. But here, we're more thinking about how do the five skandhas relate to our sticky places that we don't have to identify with anymore. And if we don't, then we can find a place to cherish ourselves more, because we realize there's really no problem. You know, a lot of times people don't love themselves because they think there's something wrong with them. But there's nothing wrong with any of us. There's characteristics that have causes and conditions, but there's nothing wrong with any of us. So I just walked through actually four of them, or five of them, just quickly, in terms of this, because it's useful. You know, the body, I mean, that makes sense that we would get kind of stuck there in this arena of self-cherishing or not, because this is the most primal sense of self is our body. And we think my body and my foot, we have all kinds of attachments and aversions about every aspect of it. And, you know, here especially, it really seems like here in our digitally interconnected culture, people are like obsessed. You think with this highly evolved human race, we wouldn't be so obsessed with how we look. But we are. And you know, as a race. So everyone's comparing, and there's all these ideals, and there's all this ridiculousness out there, and God knows what out there in digital media. And people do all kinds of gyrations to look as good as they can so that they'll feel good about themselves, as if the way they previously looked was a problem that they needed to fix. And it's crazy. Now, I did a little research. South Korea is the world's per capita leader in terms of plastic surgery. 1 in 3 women have some kind of plastic surgery. Isn't that amazing? And South Korea and Brazil has the most, with 1.5 million plastic surgery procedures in 2019. So every single one of those persons was trying to fix something about themselves so they'd feel better about themselves or be more attractive or whatever. I mean, I say this with compassion, but it jumps out at you how we are. You know, in order to love ourselves, we need to fix ourselves. And people, you know, take a lot of risk. People die in plastic surgery. It's expensive, painful, all that. So it was somehow worth it for these millions of people per year doing this. And the second skanda is Vedanas. Good old Vedanas comes up all the time. It's our instant reaction to sensory contact, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Just how we navigate reflexively life in our kind of planaria cells before we even think about what we're contacting. And one of the Vedanas we're most likely to experience is physical appearance of other people in particular. You know, who we like, who we don't, who we think is attractive, who we think isn't. It's like people walk around down the street and start going boom, 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 boom. They're making all kinds of judgments about that. And it has so much to do, and, you know, and then we think, oh, people are thinking about us. It has so much to do with whether or not people feel good about themselves. Can they cherish themselves if that's kind of what the way they're holding their sense of self? So that's one of these beautiful areas to just be mindful of it. Starts to turn the key just to see that, to be mindful of it. You can be aware to whatever degree we're doing that. I mean, I find myself doing that, and you know, I just try to be aware of it, and then it doesn't matter so much. And that's sort of, you could say, when you get down to it, these 1.5 million Brazilian people, I assume both genders, weren't feeling good about, it was unpleasant. Something was unpleasant, they thought, in how they looked. If they looked in the mirror, I don't know, whatever. And so they wanted to fix it to make the unpleasant be less. But if we can, the more we can be mindful of that, then we don't have to be yanked by that. And perceptions, that's so interesting. That's the third of the 5 skandhas. And when we start to take, you know, what we comes in through our sense doors, and then we start to structure it. Because if we didn't structure it, we'd be in this blither of uncategorized sensory experience, which we need perception to navigate the world. Got that. But then what do we do with it? You know, this is green, this is square, this is soft, this is a start identifying things as part of perception. And also, this is a beautiful person, or this is an ugly person. We do that. And I'm, you know, I'm fully mindful that I play this game myself. I'm aware of that aspect of me in terms of my perceptions and all this. I had an experience. Many, many, many years ago, I worked in an institution for developmentally disabled people in Massachusetts, and a woman came in one time who, I don't remember why she was there. I'm not sure if she was a social worker. She wasn't a resident. She was some kind of professional, but she had some kind of chronic disease that had just ravaged her face. I mean, it was, how do I say? She didn't look that good in a way, but she was completely mindful about it. And somehow we had this conversation about it. I don't know how that happened. And she was completely aware. Yeah, I know my face is a train wreck, something like that. She said she was an extraordinary person. I could just feel how amazing she was. And she had this powerful awareness of how people saw her and how she had to navigate the world because of it. It just, She wasn't letting it take her out down. It really had a big impact on me. Just this person was so perceptive and powerful and brave and conscious. It's just like, okay, fine. You know, that's how it is. And she just kept on living as successful. She was living successfully. But this perception, this labeling, you know, we can see in terms of how we look at people and how separation happens. And all this mirrors back on us. And it's the very things that we do to ourselves that keeps us from cherishing ourselves. If we think that somehow in this whole arena of kind of labeling that we're insufficient in some way, you know, maybe our career isn't as flashy as we thought or whatever it would be. You know, it's often a thing for people. We haven't written the book we thought we wanted to write, or we're not as well known, or we don't have power, or whatever it is. You know, everyone's different. Whatever it is that they might think of themselves as. To be able to just see that, go, okay, fine. You know, that's a label there. That's a perception. And it's kind of it can become like a version of sort of rank ordering people. You know, who's cooler and who isn't. I heard this real, I hope this is relevant, but I've been following the trial pretty closely. So this guy, Mr. Cohen, who's testifying, and he gave this little statement somewhere about how what he really wanted out of life was to be, what was it, to be powerful, to be well-known, to have people pay attention to him, to have a fast car, to have a plane. And it was this amazing list. But it was sort of beautifully honest in a way. It's almost like he'd woken up in a certain way. But I was really astonished how kind of honest that was. And so, in this, there's a way in which this whole area of perception in the fourth skanda is something we can see through. If we can be mindful of it and see how we're categorizing ourselves, it helps us be free and how we can then cherish ourselves. Because we often fixate on where we're not, how we haven't succeeded, how we're not as much as we want. I do that all the time, you know. Haven't accomplished the things we'd like to accomplish yet. But to be able to just be mindful of it and then let go, and then you can find that. And then mental formations, that's the fourth skanda. That's where things get really interesting. Because this is where it can be hard. And this is where I think the fourth and the fifth are where it gets harder for people to pierce this sense of having an intrinsic self, or to really start to recognize not self, because what we think, the most of us seems like who we are. You know, what was that? Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. Am I right? You think about, we humans are prone to competitions, and some of them are based on mental formations, on our thinking process. Like we compete at chess, spelling, programming, computer games, gambling, those are all have to do with our mental formations, our mental processing power, and people like position themselves against each other in terms of who wins and who loses and who's better and who's not, just because of that. And you might recognize the people who win, but there's a whole bunch of people who didn't, who don't feel so good about themselves at that point because they didn't win. And what does that mean? It's just a function. It's not intrinsically us, because there isn't any intrinsically us, but this is the one that's really easy to get hung up on. We might know the beauty's only skin deep, but to know that, you know, my ability to play a brilliant chess game is only skin deep, that's harder. People will identify with that in terms of their capability. They just think, yeah, that's who I am. I'm a great, whatever, composer or something. But just to be able to kind of start to see the causality of those different conditionings that make someone skilled or not, and realize it came from somewhere. There's nothing intrinsic. There's no such thing. It came from somewhere. Whether it's, you know, karma or genetics or training they had as a kid or how well fed they were or whatever. Or just something about their biology that makes them have an innate leaning in that direction. But there's no superior person in there anywhere. It's just conditioning. And the more we can really see that, then we're freer to just love ourselves how we are, to cherish ourselves how we are. And even consciousness, that's the subtlest of the five, you know, it can lead us to judgments about self and other. I'm kind of getting on a blurry area here, but, you know, even in the spiritual world, there could be some competition about states of consciousness, like who can do the jhanas or not, you know, the jhana wars, whether or not people can get into different jhanic concentration levels. There's like a little bit of sort of undertow of, oh, they must be better because they can do that, or, oh, I struggle with that, I do. But I know ultimately it doesn't mean anything. I know three people who can slide into the jhanas very easily. It's like ridiculous. And I wish I could, but I can't. But I've been gradually coming to understand that's just a quality. It's just a skill. It's just like being able to play a piano if someone has that proclivity. It's not something to judge myself about or anybody. So it's really freeing, and the more we can get into subtler and subtler levels of realizing all those different qualities, they're not us. And then it's so freeing because we all find places where we get stuck. And, you know, maybe in most waste areas we have a lot of sort of self-worth, but then there's a couple places where we don't feel so good about ourselves because we can't do this well enough, or we failed here, or something. And just to realize none of it matters. None of it matters. It helps. I had a conversation with Ajahn Pasano a while back. I was very fortunate. One of the senior monastics in North America, he was one of the lead disciples of Ajahn Chah. And I brought up this question of the jhanas. And he said, well, some people have a facility for one point in this. But then he said, you know, don't worry about it. He said, I'm not very good at it. He said to me, I've been doing all these years and I'm not very good at it. Which actually, I'm not sure if I believe him, because I remember being at Wat Panan Chah in 1988, when they do an all-night meditation, which I was just struggling, falling over, falling asleep, all this stuff. And every time I looked up, he was like immobile up at the front of the thing. I didn't see him move one time all night. So I'm not convinced that he can't concentrate. But nonetheless, even that isn't who we are. It doesn't determine where we go in the path. There's no sense of better or lesser. And even states of consciousness, they aren't me or mine. It's just something that's happening. There's no me or mine there. So in terms of how we bring all this into our path and the journey ahead, you know, sometimes, and forgive me, this is a weird metaphor, but I think of mindfulness practice a little bit like whack-a-mole. You know that carnival game, whack-a-mole, where these things pop up and you whack them down? It's kind of like that. You sit there, you're going to be all like settled and concentrated, and then something pops up, you know, the whole thoughting phenomena. It's like some bizarre, like, what is that? You know, some memory or some confection of the mind or some obsession or something. And it's like, oh, be mindful of that and let it do its thing. And it, you know, it'll sooner or later run out of juice and go away, I suppose. But mostly just be aware of it. But it's kind of this completely random ridiculousness that goes on. But that's okay. Because we pulled away, you know, during our formal sitting practice, we're not doing the stuff that we're normally usually concentrated on. We're not doing our jobs or working on our house or writing our poetry or whatever we do. We're just present. And what often comes up, also, for many of us, in various ways, is qualities of ourselves that we don't like so much, or foibles, or mistakes, or shortcomings. I know in longer retreats, I mean, there's a bunch of things that I did, you know, mistakes. They weren't even ill-intentioned way in the past, and the only time I think of them is in long retreat. And they'll just come up and plague me, and I'll feel really bad and guilty, and, you know, it's amazing. So it's almost like when you kind of lift the buffer of engagement, then we see deeper into things, which I think for all of us are running in the background anyway. We just don't see them. And that, because it feels like when I have that, oh, this guilt or dismay about something I did, it feels so familiar that it feels like that dismay is kind of in my psyche all the time. I just don't see it most of the time because I'm not aware enough. So, wow, we're walking around with all these conditions running. And what do? You know? So this is kind of where the miracle of mindfulness, I think it's where it's so amazing. Because every time when those come up, and it's a nice case, and I'm sure with you all, you know, all you can do is be mindful of what's happening right in that moment of appearing. You know, and you feel it in your body, and you feel the obsessive thoughts, and you feel the selfing and the tightness and all these things. But just being aware of it. There's nothing you can do. It happened decades ago. Or is some quality that you keep repeating, and it just is. But to be mindful of it, be mindful of this shortcoming, and just regard it as an object of mindfulness, then it starts to, the essence or lack of essence starts to be revealed. We're not trying to tamp it down. We're not trying to push it away. Not trying to do anything, but be mindful. See clearly. And Vipassana means clear seeing. We're doing Vipassana practice, we're clear seeing when stuff appears. And this is where the three characteristics work their magic, and it brings us to a place where we can cherish ourselves. And you can see that the cherishing ourselves is posited on the degree to which we start to realize there is no self. And then we can cherish ourselves, knowing that there's no intrinsic self. The three characteristics are so helpful. Because, you know, the first, especially, just two I want to talk about briefly, you know, the whole sense of impermanence. You know, as we look at something that comes up, we just be mindful of the changes, that it, here it is again, how it feels, but the fact that it wasn't there until it just came up now, just the changeableness, the movement of it. Because, it, you know, the problem would be if we thought it was this absolutely static thing, like my great flaw, that's always intrinsically there, just a scar on my psyche, you know, my psyche, my scar, my permanence, then we got a problem. Then people drink or something. But if we can just be mindful of it, okay, there it is, fine. And just be mindful of it, even when it hurts, even when there's guilt, whatever. You can see the movement. And the way we're seeing it now versus a few years ago, in our practice even, is different. Because it's processing and changing. And this has to do with, you know, getting back to all the ways that people are, you know, trying to be likable or attractive or trying to avoid being unlikable. The more we can just be mindful of that and see through it, it just doesn't have the same claws in us anymore. And if it doesn't, then we're freer. So we're freeing ourselves. And it's pretty, and for me, I've watched a lot, you know, my sense of self-worth relative to others. And I kind of, when that comes up in practice, and it's amazing how incredibly changeable that is. You know, sometimes I feel good about myself and sometimes I don't, but it's all this sort of, it's like clouds passing. Become more, I used to feel jerked like I, probably a lot of us, I go through a period of feeling not good about myself. And then I feel good about myself and think, oh, well, that was wrong and this is right. Then I feel bad about myself and go, oh, darn, actually, I am a wreck. And I just don't do that anymore. It's just like, okay, it just comes and goes and comes and goes. But it's just the more you can see that, then it can just let it just sort of go through its gyrations. Our unpacking's happening. It's all okay. There's causes and conditions. And there's no one here and I. And the more we see that, just watch this stuff unfold, it becomes clearer that the thing, the way we posit an I, we sort of take a particular mosaic of emerging aspects and make an I out of it. But then if those things change, whoops, well, what happened to the I we just posited? That's not working anymore because it's a new set. So you kind of, once you sort of just realize that flexibility, then you have no choice but to let go. And that's right there is describes our potential for awakening. I know I've said this sentence before, but I love it so much. The Buddha said, the mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. So the things we don't like about ourselves, you know, they're visiting, and they're only defilements. They're just like, you know, there's another sutta about the dirt on a cloth, and they're just dirt on the cloth. But the luminosity suggests the underlying potential, which isn't a thing, and there's no self, but there is luminosity. So just seeing the messiness, which is the obscuring defilements, they start to clear, like mist clears, in and of themselves, just by being seen. And the other shift, or the big shift here, is where this takes us in terms of compassion toward others. Because we start to realize that every single being is in the same boat. You know, people that we don't like so much because of some quality or habit or attitude. And when we look at people we don't like so much, it becomes clear if we really look, well, that's causes and conditions too. There's no inherent person we don't like who's uncool or bad or something that we can blame. There's reasons why they're that way. And here in our very divisive political whatever situation, that's good to keep cultivating. We just have no... There's just no space for demonizing each other. We can oppose actions people take, but that's a different matter than judging or demonizing someone else any more than we would do that to ourselves. In all cases, there's causes and conditions, and there's no intrinsic rot anywhere. This is often the case with difficult despots. Here's a short bio. Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler, his childhood was really difficult. He had an abusive and controlling father who beat him and his mother. His mother, who he was very close to, died at 17, leaving him with the abusive father. And Adolf Hitler wanted to be a painter, and his father wanted him to be a civil servant and beat him over his desire to be a painter. So, I'm not saying that's an excuse for the Third Reich, but you might get a sense of where some of that came from that made this person go into directions he did. And we can have compassion for people who do things we find abhorrent because there's causes and conditions. So it's really worth opening that up because, you know, we can't not judge others. We can't not judge ourselves unless we not judge others. They go hand in hand. We have to look at the causes and conditions of others if we're going to truly look at the causes and conditions of ourselves and cherish ourselves, just like we can cherish anybody. And that's what, you know, our animal friends are so great because they don't have cognitive speech abilities, so we can't really get into, they're like kind of like perpetually 3 years old and loving us. And they don't have, you know, they don't talk back. They don't have a lot of ideas to debate. And so we can kind of see this essence of being there. So it makes it a lot easier than our complicated humanity persons. But I find, you know, just getting a sense of Adolf Hitler as a human being, this child, this young child that you feel compassion for, regardless of what he did later on, it helps us cherish ourselves because we parallel our own conditioning and his. And, you know, in a broader sense, this recognition of the power of not-self, how none of us have an intrinsic self, we're only a collection of conditions, it brings us freedom. We just don't have to get stuck anywhere. And so we can have that same toward ourselves. Yep, you know, and the truth is, there's nothing to judge. And this really takes us, you know, here we see the possibility of disenchantment because we're not stuck in terms of aversion and grasping so much, the more we realize none of it's inherently desirable and see how much of the conditionings of grasping and aversion are just built around a whole bunch of people trying to, you know, have themselves be more attractive or were grasping onto our own ideas of that. And the more we can let go, the more we move toward awakening. I'm going to stop there. How about if we just sit for a moment?